Thank you for listening to Torah Media Atlanta. Won't you consider making a donation to help support this important work? Just go to TorahMediaAtlanta.com and click on the donate link. Thank you very much.
All right, let us continue. So you're coming in the middle of the story, but we'll catch you up to speed as best we can. We are holding Yaakov and Esav. We are up to Pasuk Chaf Dalet 24. We are going through the story of Yaakov and Esav, the three major episodes that the Torah describes of their interactions. We are in episode number one, which we have broken down into two parts. What we're going to do is we're going to finish the first part of the first episode today, God willing. So the first part has to do with their birth, which is from Parshas told us a couple of weeks ago. And what we went through all of the verses already just to get all of the questions out on the table. And now we're working it through with some of the commentaries, and then we'll go through it again and hopefully put it all together once you finish with the commentaries. But let's, right now we're up to verse 24, 25, 26. Let's see if we can get through that today. And that will conclude part one. So where we're up to so far, just quick review, is the pregnancy, the barrenness really of Rivka. Yitzchak and Rivka are not able to have a child. They daven, and Rivka conceives. She has clearly some type of issue with her pregnancy. It is beyond the pale of normal. She goes to seek of Hashem what is going on, and she's told this prophecy, which we spent some time on, this four-part prophecy, that there actually are two nations inside your womb. They're going to separate into two different regimes. Might will pass from one to the other, and the elder will serve the younger. So that's where we left off last week with our discussions of the idea. Rashi had quoted that these two nations of Edom and of the Jews, Rome and the Jewish nation, will always be in a seesaw battle. When one is up, one will by definition be down, and when one is down, the other will be able to be up. And that's the nature of Western civilization. The Jewish people are in a constant conflict, so to speak, of power, and they won't share the world stage. When one has power, the other one is without, and then one will have, the other will be. And that is already prophesied to Rivka with her children in her womb, that there are two of these babies in there. Two nations will be separated, and might will always be passing from one to the other. And at the end, it's going to be the younger who will be in charge, and that the elder will serve the younger. And the last comment that we had seen, I believe, was from the Ramban, that the idea that not that the elder will be vanquished by the younger, will disappear from the face of the earth, but that the elder, this Western civilization, will serve the younger, and that all of their resources and their technology and everything that they have to offer will be used for the betterment of the Jewish nation in terms of us being able to fulfill our mission, and they will simply will marshal in all of their capabilities and their strengths to that. And that was some form of a consolation to Rivka as she's dealing with this difficult pregnancy, that they were going to be these two, and that the elder would eventually help serve the younger. Okay, that catches us up. That's like 5 weeks you got all in those.
You didn't miss
a thing. Okay, so what you have in front of you are three different commentaries. We have just the verses, which is right in front of you. We have the commentary of Rashi in the white, the Ramban in the blue, and Rav Shamshon Rafal Hirsch in the yellow. And we will be bouncing around through all of them as we go along verse by verse. Let's pick it up with verse Chavdalad, Pasuk Chavdalad. Vayimlu'u yameho l'ledes. Her term to bear grew full. Vihine somim bivitna. And behold, there were twins in her womb. Now, when we learned this, we had a question on this verse, just ourselves, and that was, anyone remember?
We already know that they're twins.
Correct. The word vihine almost always seems to imply some sort of a surprise. Behold, look, and it was such. Well, well, the previous verse just told Rivka. Rivka herself knew, the mother of these twins, knew that she was carrying twins. She knew that she was carrying two children in her womb. So when the verse then says, in the very next pasuk, and her term grew full, and behold, vihine, there were twins in there. There's got to be some element of a surprise to someone that there were these twins. So we commented, who is the most likely candidate who was surprised? It would be Yitzchak. In other words, this would be a possible source for the question which we've raised every single time we've gotten together, and we're going to continue to raise throughout the story. Did Yitzchak know this prophecy or not? Does the father of these two boys, is he made aware of the fact that they are going to go in divergent ways, that there's going to be two separate regimes, and might's going to pass from one to the other, and that the elder's going to serve the younger. Does he know that or not? So the simple reading of the text would say no, we're not told anywhere that she tells him. And this might be a hint towards that, that the verse describes, and look, they were twins, as if somebody was surprised. And if that would be the father, Yitzchak, that would be, clearly show that he had never indeed been told about that. That's an option, we'll leave it on the table. The other options we'll see in a few moments. If you remember, we've seen already that Rav Hirsch commented that she did tell him. He reads the story as if they both are aware of this information, which means there must be some other element of surprise in their birth. So we'll leave that, I'm not confusing you, with two options. Either the surprise is from Yitzchak, and he does not know that they were twins. He does not know any of these prophecies. He does not know what the future has in store for these two boys. Or he does, and there's some other surprise, which we will see in a moment. Let's take a look at Rashi, your white long sheets. It's on the third or fourth page in, page 276. Let's start with his comment on this verse. He is just one or two. Okay, Rashi elucidated verse 24. Vayimlu, see where I am? When her term to bear grew full, about Tamar, it is written, and it came to pass at the time she gave birth. So this is in this week's Parsha. We're going to find that Yehuda lives with his sister, his daughter-in-law, Tamar, unbeknownst to him that the woman whom he is with is actually his daughter-in-law. And then the Torah describes that it came to pass that she gave birth. So Rashi's bothered by, why doesn't it say there that her term grew full? It just said her time to give birth came, and Rashi points out her term was actually not full. She gave birth to her twins after only 7 months. We're going to leave aside what the difference is, why, what difference is it whether or not the significance of full term 7 months. We'll leave that aside for now. I want to focus on the next comment of Rashi. Vihine somim, then behold, it was twins. The word tomim, twins, is spelled lacking letters. It doesn't have with the aleph. It should be spelled the tough aleph vav mem, as you see Rashi spells it out in the next phrase. When Tamar gives birth to her two children, it's spelled in full. What's the significance of the word twins being spelled missing letters? Now again, in Hebrew, there are letters which can or cannot be there, which may or may not change the pronunciation. A vav, an aleph. It could be there, and we could vowelize it so that it reads the same. But these sages often pick up on there's a meaning or a message somehow in the letter either being there or not being there. And Rashi points out the difference is when Tamar, in this week's parasha, the daughter-in-law of Yehuda, gives birth to her twins, they're both righteous. And because they're both righteous, it's spelled in full. She had full twins in the full spelling of the word, Avalkan, but here one was righteous and one was wicked. These twins are not both equally righteous, one is wicked, and therefore the word twins is spelled missing. Now, why is this significant? Because we are gathering evidence to the major question we're going to have to address. At what point was it determined that Esav was going to be wicked? We're here, we're dealing with the womb here. We're dealing before free will has kicked in. We're dealing before decisions have been made. And we're going to compile all of our evidence where we see already from that early stage the way the sages address Esav. We clearly have a prophecy that they're going to split Yaakov and Esav into two different ways. They're going to go into two different directions. And here we have another piece of evidence as we go through the story, that when the Torah describes their birth as twins coming out of the womb, the word for twins is spelled missing an aleph. It's not a full spelling of the word. And the sages commented to tell you there was something missing in the womb. One of the children wasn't righteous. One of the children was wicked. And therefore tinted at this spelling. So again, we're going to add that to our evidence of already at birth, the Torah takes away a letter from the word for twins to show one of the sons was going to be righteous and one was indeed going to be wicked. There is no Ramban in this. Let's take a look at Rav Hirsch, your yellow sheets. The Ramban, verse 24, Rav Hirsch, verse 24 is on page, it's upside down, that's on page 423. Everybody see where I am? On the bottom of page 423. Yes? Give me a second. Okay? Says Rav Hirsch. Hinei always introduces something unexpected, which we've mentioned. So we have one option on the table so far. Behold, they were children, they're twins. Either it means that Yitzchak didn't know about it and he was surprised, which would be evidence for the approach again of he doesn't know anything. Rav Hirsch is not going to go that route. As Rebecca had already been fully informed that she had two boys in her womb, now that this fact is established, it could not have been unexpected, so that the Vihine cannot refer to that. Rav Hirsch is not willing to entertain the surprise as being Yitzchak. He's already stated explicitly elsewhere that Yitzchak does know about this. So, what is the surprise? Why is their birth introduced with the word in the Torah that leads to, like, look at this, there were twins? The opposite seems to be the case. Meaning, listen to how he describes this. It's just the opposite. The surprise was in the twins. Not that there were twins, but how the twins came out. After she had been told of the contrasting difference between the expected children, flipping over your page, top of page 424. In other words, you put yourself in Rivka and Yitzchak's shoes. You've just been told about a prophecy that there are two nations in your womb. They're going to split into two regimes. One will serve the other. Might will pass from one to the other. What would you expect to come out? Identical twins or non-identical twins? So if Hirsch suggests, given the prophecy that they've been told as to the divergent paths that they're going to take in life, says the first top line on 424, one would have thought that they would be non-identical twins and not, and look, not at all alike. The surprising, the vihine was, I have this prophecy that I'm going to have these two boys, they're going to go into two different paths. I have a hint that one is righteous and one is wicked. I don't know where they're going to go. And look! Look what comes out! The surprising thing was that they were really identical twins. The only difference was in their constitution, that the one, as we are immediately told, was much more developed, stronger than the other. But that they looked, they were identical twins. Esav is fully developed, meaning he was hairy, he looked like he was already an older child. But he was fully identical to Yaakov. In other words, the children were identical twins. One was just more developed than the other. Now, the Torah clearly describes to us that they had different characteristics. Esav is fully made hairy.
Red.
And red. But they were identical twins.
Where did you read that?
So he's reading that into the Vihine. Vihine somim. And behold, they were twins.
He's asking himself, why Vihine?
So and as we would suggest a possibility, as it was a surprise to Yitzchak, he didn't know he was going to have twins. Rav Hirsch, who's going to read through this whole story with Yitzchak knowing this prophecy, is looking for what's the vihine, what's the surprise? So he's suggesting the words, vihine somim, and behold, look, they were twins. They actually are exactly alike, just one has clearly developed more, but that when the other catches up, they're not going to be non-identical, they're going to be identical twins, and they have this divergent path set out in front of them. Says Rav Hirsch, continues Rav Hirsch, perhaps also the way the word is spelled. Now he's also picking up on the misspelled word. It's clearly misspelled in the Torah. It should have had an aleph in it, and there's not. Rashi pointed out, what was the significance of the misspelling word, of the misspelled word? One was lacking. He wasn't righteous. Says Rav Hirsch, perhaps also the way the word is spelled, meaning lacking the aleph, it's also lacking a vav, points to the exterior complete apparent similarity. On the outside, they look similar. This complete exterior similarity, taken together with a complete dissimilarity, which had been predicted that would develop in the future, could well have been designed to draw attention to the fact that the germ of this future dissimilarity lay deep below the surface. And so by the means of bringing about that this deep inner difference in the two boys be specifically or especially studied quite early. I'm going to read that again because that was a very long-winded sentence.
Yeah.
A classic Rav Hirsch line, which it really wasn't because it was only about 6 lines long, and some of his sentences are 10 to 15 lines long. Rav Hirsch is going to point out he's foreshadowing a major approach that he is going to suggest in this entire episode, which we're going to get to. We might be able to introduce still today. How do you raise twins? How do you address boys, two boys, similar, who have different positions in life, different objectives, different goals and missions? So Rav Hirsch is foreshadowing the way that he's going to address the way that they were raised, with the fact that we have a prophecy in advance that they were different, and vihine, but they look so alike. And so if I'm looking at something and I see something that's like-minded, or physically, externally the same, and I know that internally they're going in very different ways, what does that highlight to me, the observer, that there's more than meets the eye? It's highlighting the fact, which is always true. Anytime I look at a human being, I need to know that there's really more beneath the surface than exactly what it is that I see right then and there. But if you contrast, I'm told about two people, and I'm told they're going to go in the most different paths in life. Okay, that's fine. And then I see them, and I say, whoa, that's weird, because they look identical. If they would look totally different, and you told me they were going to go in different paths, okay, fine, I don't know, two people going in different paths in life, that doesn't bother me. But now you told me that they're going in two totally different routes, two totally different paths, and then when I meet them, I see externally similarity, then it focuses me on, you're going to have to scrape beneath the surface to find out what's driving these two individuals, because it's highlighted by how different they must be internally, because externally they're the same, but I know that they're going in different places. So Rav Hirsch is going to take this theme throughout this story, that we have these two boys headed in different directions who needed different things in their upbringing, and it's highlighted by Vihine, look! They look the same! He's seeing in the surprise of the Vihine that external similarity, contrasted by the prophecy of the internal dissimilarity. Take note. Be careful not to be fooled by externals. These boys need different things. I'm going to read that again in his words with that introduction, and I think you'll see that's exactly what he's saying. Start with that last sentence, which is six lines up, believe it or not. This complete exterior similarity, taken together with a complete dissimilarity, which had been predicted would develop in the future, could well have been designed to draw attention to the fact that the germ of this future dissimilarity lay deep below the surface. And so by the means of bringing about that this deep inner difference in the two boys be specially studied quite early.
As a parent, he would have already seen that these two are divergent characters.
So that, well, you're asking the question that is part of our study of what is it, what happens with these two boys, who knew what. That's going to be the next couple verses. Esau's ability to fool his father Yitzchak, how did he fool him, what did Yitzchak see in him, where were the blessings coming from? You're jumping beyond
true.
That.
Yeah, because that's what he's
We're not there yet. Hang on. All that we got right now is that we have two approaches in the Vihine. When the boys are born, we have a surprise.
Yeah.
One approach which we're suggesting is it's Yitzchak's surprise. He didn't know there were going to be twins. He didn't know the prophecy. First is suggesting he did know the prophecy. The surprise is, look at how similar they look. One is hairier and redder, but look, if you look carefully, they're exactly the same. And how odd that is, after having received a prophecy of how dissimilar they're going to be, how similar they look, and it's designed that way, Rav Hirsch suggests, to say to the parents, look deep, because the germ that's going to develop into, it's going to push them in their own different ways, is clearly deep below the surface. Don't lose sight of it despite the external similarities that you'll see on the surface. So far, so good? Let's move on. Verse 25. Keep your sheets open to the place where you get right back to them. Don't close them up so fast. Verse 25. Vayetze Arishon Admoni, the first one emerged red. Kulo ka'aderes se'ar, entirely like a hairy mantle. Vayikru'u Shemo Esav, and they called him Esav. So the Torah here describes, as we've seen, the birth of the first. The first was he's described as the first. The first one emerges, and he's red and he's hairy. The two ways in which he's described, we have physical descriptions of Esav's birth, with redness and with hairiness. And who calls him Esav?
They.
They. Whoever the they is, the verse doesn't name it. But it's a public naming. It's a plural naming of Esav. Esav comes from the word asu, which means made, fully formed. He was born formed. He was born developed. Hair, as we'll see, Rav Hirsch is going to write, is a sign of healthy development, that the body has the energy, so to speak, to develop the hair. It means everything else was already covered, and we have this excess, so to speak, energy, if you will, to put into the development of hair. Reddish color is a healthy child at his birth. He's fully made and fully developed, and he's called Esav. Let's take a look. Let's take a look at Rashi. Rashi's got a couple comments here as well. Redness, what's the sign of red? Let's go through. The Torah gives us two visible descriptions of Esav, that he was both red and that he was hairy. So let's see in the commentaries, Rashi and Rav Hirsch, and give us different insights as to what's the significance of those two things. Says Rashi back on the white long sheets, where we left off, page 276, middle of the page, Admoni, he was red. Says Rashi, Simanhu, it's a sign that he will be a spiller of blood. I didn't put that in our list of clues or information that we have. What does it mean that he was red? Now, Rav Hirsch is going to give us, as I already gave to you, I mentioned a moment ago, that red can also just mean that he was healthy. Rashi says, the sages see in the redness of his cheeks more than just a sign of health, but a sign of blood. His cheeks are red as the blood flows in, and that he is going to be one who will cause blood to flow. All of him was like a hairy mantle, full of hair, like a woolen cloak, which is full of hair. Something in Old French.
Was King David also known to be red and ruddy?
Yes.
So is it the same Hebrew?
Yes.
The same word,
blood.
Yeah, and the same idea. In other words, there is an idea that the Talmud talks about, which hopefully we'll get to, of that a person can... The Gemara describes that if a person is born under a certain constellation, it's a sign that he will be a spiller of blood. There are different other 12 constellations. So the Gemara says, so all that means is that he has that type of personality. Will he become a butcher? Will he become a moel? Will he become a murderer? And everybody has... different people are drawn to different things. He could become a surgeon. He could become all sorts of things. But there's the idea of being born under a certain constellation, we say Mazel Tov, which is really where that comes from, is that your child should be born under a good Mazel, a good constellation, that should be for a blessing. And then we all have the opportunity to do with it what it is that we choose. Certain people, as we just know this, like certain people are like, they're just made to be surgeons. They just have that personality type. Or butchers, or moels, and other people just don't. They can't stand it. But that same personality type, that if it could be a little bit corrupted, could end up doing other harmful type things. But it's a category. So King David also had that same redness, and was involved in many battles. And right. Indeed, he was. Vayikru Shmo Esav, continues Rashi, they called him Esav. Everyone called him so. Rashi picking up on what we did, why is it plural that they called him Esav? Because he was fully made and completed with respect to his hair, like one many years old. So everybody who saw him said, Esav, this is just an Esav. This is a child who was fully made, who was done. He was well cooked by the time he came out. And therefore, the plural, the people who saw him, all called him Esav. Okay, a couple comments from Rashi. Let's take a look at a quick comment from Rav Hirsch, back in your yellow sheets. Admoni, middle of the page. The same is said of David. Just like Harriet has said. Well, Rav Hirsch and Harriet are on the same wavelength. On page 424, in the middle of the page, verse 25. Admoni, he was red.
That's true.
Yeah, that's how I feel. The same is said of David in Samuel and Shmuel Aleph, that he was red-cheeked. He was ruddy, which is a sign of radiant health. Now, he was also hairy. Esav is described in a way that not only was he reddish, he was also hairy. Hair at newborn babies is a sign that there is sufficient strength and life force to spare for the development of hair, which usually only gets developed properly later. And in this case, not merely on the head, but the whole body was covered with down. That is why they called him, i.e. all those who were present at the birth, Esav from Asa, made. an already finished, completely made man. He brought life from his red cheeks and protective strength, meaning from his hair, in full measure already with him into the world. So Esav is described as being fully formed. Now again, we pointed out, and we'll see again in a moment, the difference between Yaakov's description and Esav's description. Esav's description is a very physical one. We're told about his physical characteristics. He's red, which on a simple level or first size means he was healthy. He was hairy, again meaning he was strong, ready to take on the world. And we're going to not have those types of descriptions by Yaakov. But stopping here for a moment, what would you say is the significance of Esav being born ready to tackle the world?
Hunter, number one, he's going to be sort of strong and healthy.
Fighter, hunter, healthy, all good, yep.
And he's going to have to fight for his rights.
If you were looking at it from a spiritual set of eyeglasses in terms of this world versus the next world, the significance of Esav being fully formed, fully healthy, which...
He's meant more for this.
This is his place. He's born ready for the place that will be his. Of his permanence. Esav is a this-worldly character, and look, he's born with everything that he'll need for his mission. He is healthy, fully developed, ready to go and take his place.
The material world.
Correct. Okay, let's move on to Yaakov's birth. We're moving along. Verse 26, and afterwards, after the first one was born, coming out with his reddish, hairy description that we're told about, Yotza Ochiv, his brother emerged, V'yado Ochezes Ba'akev Esav, and his hand was grasping onto the heel of Esav, V'yikra Shmo Yaakov, and he called his name Yaakov, Yaakov from the name Akev, heel. The Yitzchak ben Shishim Shana Beledes Osam. And Yitzchak was 60 years old at the time of their birth, which on a simple level, we worked backwards when we originally learned these psukim, since we know that it was 20 years that they had not, since the Torah tells us that he was 40 when he got married, and now the Torah tells us that he was 60 when the twins were born, so we know that it was about 20 years of barrenness in which Yitzchak and Rivka did not have any children. Now we have these twins, and we have this description of Yaakov, not a description of his physical characteristics. We're not told that he wasn't hairy, we're not told that he was hairy, we're not told about his skin color, we're not told anything. We're just told that he's born. What we are told about is the physical description of how he was born. He had his hand on his brother's heel. Let's take a look at what some of the commentators have to say on this. Start with Rashi. Continue where we left off. Rashi's on the top of page 2277. Have I gotten you guys dizzy yet, going back and forth?
Yes.
Says Rashi. Rashi is going to start with an agadic midrash. Now, for those of you coming to our Svarim class, so you know when you hear a midrash, and the midrash has no halachic bearing, it's not teaching us anything in halacha, so the way that you need to read it is, what is the message that the sages are trying to convey to us through this midrash? Because they're not telling me a halacha, they're not telling me anything relevant to my practical life, but they have something to say here. So how do we read it? Listen to this midrash. Says Rashi, after that his brother emerged, I have heard an agadic midrash, Rashi says, which interprets it as follows according to its simple meaning. Jacob, Yaakov, was grasping at Esav by right, meaning to claim that I have the right to have been born first, and I'm grasping at you to try to hold you back, that I should be able to have come out first. Now, what difference does it make who comes out first? Well, we know throughout the story of Bereishis, the firstborn carries on the legacy of the family. The firstborn has a significant right, and Yaakov is going to lose that here to Esav. Esav is going to come out first. Now we know that they were, so to speak, fighting in the womb. If you remember the Rashi that we studied on Vayisrotzitzu Habanim Bekirba, that the children were agitating in her, is that Rashi quoted the first interpretation of that they both wanted to get out at different times. The second interpretation, they were actually fighting over this world and the next world. And the Esav emerges first with the rights of all the firstborn, but Yaakov's holding on to his heel. Says the Medrash, he was holding on to his heel saying, wait a minute, I have the right to have been born first. trying to prevent him, says Rashi, from emerging from the womb first, because Yaakov was formed from the first drop, meaning Yaakov was conceived actually first, and Esau from the second. How do we know this, says the Medrash? Because you can demonstrate this from a tube whose opening is narrow, and if you put two stones into it, the stone which goes in first will come out last. Because if there's a narrow tube and you put the first stone in, you put the second stone in, and then you flip them over to get them out, which one comes out first? The second one comes out first, because it's obviously on top in a narrow tube. So that if Esav is coming out first, it's an indication that he was actually the second of the children to have been conceived. The one that goes in last, continuing in Rashi, will come out first. It thus turns out that Esav, who was formed afterwards, emerges first, and therefore Yaakov, who was formed first, emerged afterwards. So that Yaakov came to prevent Esav from leaving the womb ahead of him, so that he should be first by birth, as he was first by being formed, and therefore he should issue first from the womb and take the birthright of the firstborn by right. And the Medrash. Now, as we know from today's, you know, in the womb, our expecting mommies can tell us, like, those kids are moving, it's not this narrow tube. Now, maybe the birth canal is actually on their way out, but certainly what's going on there in between. But the Medrash has to say, the fact that Esav came out first was an indication that he was actually conceived second, and the holding on to his heel that Yaakov has, holding him back, was an attempt to say, I really should be the one entitled to come out first. I'm the one entitled to the status of the firstborn and all of those rights. But meanwhile, Esav is the one who actually is born first. We'll put that Medrash aside. That's interpretation number one of what it means that Yaakov is holding on to the heel. Although that's not really saying so much to holding on to the heel, but the idea of him holding on to Esav was that. What does it mean? Let's backtrack and ask the question, which we've asked before. That's why I sort of jumped right into this. We could have asked it. I spoke in shul. I think I spoke both upstairs and downstairs. So if you were in shul on that Shabbos, you'll remember when I spoke about this parsha, and parsha's told us. So the way that I introduced this was, there was a young couple who were expecting their first child, and they'd been waiting for many years to have this child, and they were thinking about names because it was just a meaningful birth. And they had chosen a slew of names that would somehow express, whether it be a boy or a girl, their hopes and aspirations. And now here was this joyous moment. And as the child emerges from the womb, they see that his right hand is holding on to his right earlobe. And they both look at each other and they say, are you thinking what I'm thinking? And she says, yeah, absolutely. We're going to name him Earlobe. And they say, absolutely, it's just perfect. And he goes through his whole life and he introduces himself as Earlobe. And everybody asks him, why are you called Earlobe? And he explains, because when I was born, I was, and they say, right. So that's what we would say. If we would meet somebody who introduced himself as Lobe for short and told us that story, we would think his parents were crazy. So why is Yitzchak not that story? Here we have Yaakov being born and he's holding on to his brother's heel. So what? So what's the significance of that? And you're going to name our shul, Beit Yaakov, after the fact that this child Yaakov was holding on to the heel? So what? So clearly it's not a so what, because the Torah tells us about it. If it was just Yaakov holding on to his right earlobe, so we wouldn't be told about it. Many, many children are born in the Torah, many children, and we're not told about the finger positions of any of them. We don't know, because it doesn't matter. It's really not significant. So clearly Yaakov holding on to the heel is significant, which we're going to get to the interpretations as to in what way. So Rashi here offers us the first, it was a sign of trying to hold back, trying to bring back in, trying to say, I have the right to have come out first. What gives Yaakov the right to come out first? Why would he be trying to keep Esav in? So the sages say, because he was conceived first. Out of the twins, which drop, so to speak, was the first one, the first child to be formed, it was Yaakov, and therefore he was trying to assert his right to come out first. Interpretation number one, we'll leave it on the table, we'll get to some others. Continues Rashi. Ba'akev Esav, why specifically the heel? Says Rashi, Siman, this is a sign that this one will not have the chance to end his rule before the other arises and takes it from him. The heel is the end of the body. It's the very bottom. It's the very end. The head of the body, the top of the body, so to speak, is of course the head. The place where the mind is, the brain, the ability to think and to reason. That's the crown of the body. Nobody wears a crown on their foot. You wear a crown on your head. That signifies the Rosh. So the heel is obviously then, if the head is the top, so then your heel is going to be on the opposite extreme. The heel is going to be the very bottom. Hey, Faye, come on in.
I'm sorry, I have an appointment.
That's all right. Glad to have you.
Yeah, we're still talking.
So the heel is going to be the very end. So what does it mean, says Rashi, that the part of the body, maybe Yaakov could have been holding on to his hand. As his arm emerged, Yaakov would have been holding on to the arm of Esau, trying to drag him back down. So no, he's holding on to the heel. The heel is the very end. Says Rashi, it signifies, it's a sign that Esau and Western civilization, represented by Rome, will have their time in the spotlight. They will have their time to shine, to rule the world. But before it's quite finished, at the very end, Yaakov is going to come and take it. So just when it seems that they're at the end of their reign, they're at the end of the authority, the ruling of Edom, of Esau, of the Roman Western civilization, then you can expect that Yaakov will come and take it from him. Rome as represented by the Western civilization as we know. We are in today what's referred to as the exile of Rome, and we are still the culture, the civilization, the mindset that we have today in Western civilization is born out of Roman thought and culture, and we're still in that exile. One last two more actually from Rashi. He called his name Yaakov. Rashi gives us two interpretations. Now the problem here again is, who named Esav? It was a they, it was a plural, everybody who saw him. And yet when we get to Yaakov's being named, it's singular, he called him Yaakov. Well, who's the he in the verse? Who names Yaakov Yaakov? Rashi gives us two interpretations. Number one, says Rashi, HaKadosh Baruch Hu. The Holy One, blessed is he, names Yaakov himself. And Rashi quotes the Medrash. Hashem says, you have given a name to your firstborn, I will give a name to my firstborn. Yaakov, the Jewish people, are the firstborn. B'ni b'chori Yisrael, the Torah says. You are my firstborn children, you the children of Yisrael. So Hashem says, I'm going to name my firstborn, my Yaakov, I'm going to give him the name. And therefore the Vayikra, the singular naming, here is done by none other than Hashem himself. Dovar Acher, alternatively, says Rashi, his father called him Yaakov because of the grasping of the heel. But it was specifically Yaakov. Now what Rashi leaves out, and leaves for a first to fill in, is in the same way as if I name my son Earlobe, you would all laugh at me and say, we're calling defects on you because you're setting your child up for a lifetime of humiliation. Rashi here says, Yitzchak names Yaakov, Yaakov, because of the fact that he's holding onto the heel of his brother. Which begs the question of, what did Yitzchak see in this that made sense to name his child after it? It has to be more than just this insignificant holding onto your right earlobe, because only Yitzchak sees it. Yitzchak alone names him Yaakov. There's something there that he sees that demands of him to actually name his child such. Okay, let's take a look at Rav Hirsch.
Is that the first place that says that?
It says what?
God acknowledges that Yaakov is my firstborn.
Probably. So we could add that to our list of pieces of information.
That
here we have, at their birth already, another statement from the sages already taking sides on the Yaakov-Esav twin phenomena, saying, that one's mine.
Which is very unusual.
That's just
right. This is another one from the Midrasha. This is from the sages, that as we have the fact that the name is misspelled to show that one is wicked. We have all of these ideas already foreshadowing as to what Esav will be. And this is already in the womb. He's a baby. He's just coming out of the womb. And we already had quite a number of statements that indicate that it was known where he was going.
No pressure.
Let's take a look at the first bottom of page 424. Vayikra. Rav Hirsch is going to pick up on that which we were just talking about now, this idea of the singular name calling, that Yitzchak alone, somebody names Yaakov, Yaakov, and it is not the they that was what we found when it came to Esav. Then he, Isaac, calls him Yaakov. So Rav Hirsch goes with Rashi's second approach, not that it's God himself naming Yaakov, but that this is Yitzchak, his father, naming him. What Rashi did not tell us is why would Yitzchak name him after this incident? Why was it so significant that he was holding on to his brother's heel? Says Rav Hirsch, the others present pay no attention to this fact. The reason why it's singular is because everybody else saw it, and everybody else said to themselves, oh, how cute, look, he's holding onto his brother's heel. As if he were holding onto his earlobe, as if he had his hand on his head, whatever. Nobody else saw any significance in the fact that he was holding onto his heel, other than Yitzchak. But Yitzchak did indeed do so, and that's why it says, Vayikra, and he called him Yaakov. Only Yitzchak saw in this something worthwhile of a name. The child looked almost exactly like Esav. Again, Rav Hirsch, according to his approach in this, sees the twins as really being identical. I ask the question, how come we're not told anything about Yaakov's birth? Yitzchak, Esav, we're told, is red, he's hair. Rav Hirsch ones, because they really were very, very similar. But what specialized each baby was a contrast. But still, the Torah is telling us something different about each child. Esav's specialty was his outward appearance, meaning his personality, that which you could see on the outside. And Yaakov's lay in what he was doing, or in the position he adopted. Something that he's doing, not something that you can see, but something that he was doing in the position that he had is what established Yaakov. And Yitzchak therefore called him Yaakov, meaning he will come from behind. Now, Akev, the word Akev, means three things. And Rafersh is alluding to something. Let's read one more line, then I'll explain more what he means. He allows Esav the precedence, but follows at his heels. He is just that Seir, the lesser one, the weaker one, who unexpectedly will finally be the first. Akev is used in three different ways in this Parsha alone. Parsha's told us. But it's in the Torah it's used in three ways. Akev means primarily a heel, which we find in a couple of places. We find it here, that Yaakov was holding onto Akev Esav Achiv, onto the heel of his brother Esav. Where else does the word heel already appeared in the very first parsha of the Torah?
Oh, the snake.
Excellent, the snake. The snake, the Torah says, on the snake, you will bite at man's heel, and he will clobber your head. But that you're going to bite at his heel. So we find the word Akev to mean a heel. Akev also means to swindle, to be sneaky. When Esav, as we'll learn in episode number 2, has the bracha stolen from him, he says, Ya'akveni ze po'amayim. He has now swindled me twice. Once he bought the blessing from me, which is our episode, which is the end of our first episode number 1. And then he says, and now he stole the bracha from me. But he uses the word Yaakveni. He swindled me out of this. So Akev means a heel, means to swindle, and it also has a parsha named after it. Parsha's Akev, which means, actually means after. In the context means, as a result of your following my mitzvos, I will reward you with this. But it means following on the heels of, like afterwards, after this, after you do this, I will give you this.
Can he translate it unexpectedly?
So Rav Hirsch is going to say, and he explains this at length, and he's alluding to it here, that Akev always means something unexpected. Something which comes afterwards, which I wasn't necessarily expecting. It comes at the end of the body. At the very end is where I'm going to find it. And I'm swindled out of something. He introduces this because I was expecting things to go one way. And all of a sudden it ends up going somewhere else. The reward the Torah uses for our mitzvahs is always Akev. The word schar, Rav Hirsch points out, is very almost never used in the Torah itself. Schar, reward, which is the way that the sages often use that word, comes from the word socher, means to be missing something, to plug something that's missing. Meaning, I work for you, I'm missing my time or resources or my energy, and the reward you give me fills in, plugs in the hole that I gave to you. I gave you something, and you compensate me. The significance of that is it's always addressed in advance. You hire me, and we determine before I start to work, what's it going to cost for it to be worth it for me, so to speak, to do this. This is what I charge. Anything less than that, it's not worth it for me to give this up because I'm not being compensated. Literally in that word, I'm not being filled with what I'm giving for this project. Schar is almost always the concept of something that you plan in advance. Ekev is a very different type of word for reward. It means you did it without any thought process of what was coming. Now, after it's been done, I'll tell you, this is what I'm going to give you for it. Not because you did it for that. You did it because you had another reason to do it. You wanted to do it. You felt you needed to do it. Whatever it may be. Ekev, on the heels of your actions, not from the head of your actions. From the head would indicate we're planning this merosh, from the start. If you do this, I'll give you this. Ekev says, on the heels of what you did, I will give you this. Not because you were expecting it, but it's on the heels of what you did. After you've done it, now that it's done, I'd like to give you this as a reward. Mitzvos, that refers writes, Parshas Ekev is Ekev Asher Tishmu, because you listen, a Jew doesn't do mitzvah by saying, okay, well, Shabbos is coming, let's see. If I keep Shabbos, I'm going to get X, Y, or Z. That's worth it. I'll do it. That's not how we do mitzvahs. We do mitzvahs because Hashem said to do it. He's our creator. We are His servant. We are His servant. We do it. Hashem tells us, Ekev, as a result of what you did, I'll take care of you. Don't worry. But I don't want you to have the attitude of schar. This isn't a contract in which you ask me if it's worth it or not. How much are you going to get? No. You do it because of why you're doing it. As a result of that, I'll give you something. Analogous example that I've used also in a drasha. Rosh Hashiva here is in town for a wedding, and I'm in charge of finding him a ride, so I go over to one of the boys in town and I say that Rosh Hashiva would like a ride to the airport. Are you available to take him? And he says to me, how much does he pay? So he says, well, forget it, never mind, I'm asking someone else. That's the wrong approach. I'm asking you, you have the opportunity to take the Rosh Hashiva to the airport, and you're asking, and he says, yeah, well, it's going to cost me in gas, and it's going to take an hour of my time. Never mind. Just never mind.
But he could be down to his last dollar. You have to have the compassion to see the other side as well.
And he's still wrong.
And I'm still going to say, never mind, you're not the person who's going to take him.
Right.
So I'm looking for someone who says, I have the opportunity to take the Rosh Hashiva. Right. Yeah. Now, let's say he drives him, and then at the end, Rosh Hashiva says, I really appreciate it. I'd like to give you $20 for the gas. He's like, no, this is such an honor. So the Rosh Hashiva might say, I know, but I know that there's another side. It cost you, and I don't want to be the cause. I'm happy that you were honored to take me. I'd like to just come. That's a totally different relationship than when we say, well, how much are you going to pay me for it? So the Torah uses the word for reward always, Ekev. Ekev is a heel. It's afterwards. It's unexpected. The bachar who takes him to the airport is not expecting the Rosh Hashiva to take out a $20 bill. And in fact, he says, I don't even need it. I just wanted the experience. But Hashem says to us, Ekev, as long as it's you're always thinking, I just want, you're giving me an opportunity to serve you. You're giving me the opportunity to keep Shabbos, to keep kosher, to keep mitzvahs. Of course. And Hashem says, afterwards, this is what I'm going to give you. But that's the attitude. It's always that's on the heel, which is why swindling has the same word of on the heel. I thought things were going like this, and then all of a sudden, from underneath my feet, you switch the terms on me. It's a term of unexpected, after the fact, I was sure things were going like this, and then it ends up not that way. Cesar first, Yitzchak, sees his son, the second child being born, holding on to the heel of his older brother. Says Rav Hirsch, again, reading it inside, Yitzchak calls him Yaakov because he will come behind. He's going to come at the end. It's going to be unexpected. He allows Esav the precedence. The whole world is going to be a Rome Esav world. Looking out at the world for 2,000 years, you would say, who rules? Who runs this place? Who controls what's going on? It's Esav. It's an Esav world. It's an Esav culture. It's an Esav value system. But then, following on his heels, unexpected, the whole world is going to be like, huh? What? It's not really an Esav world? These values, this system that we have, this culture, is really not truth? following on his heels at the very end will come a Yaakov. He is just that Seir, the younger one that the Pasuk had said, the lesser one, the weaker one, who unexpectedly will finally be the first. And when the world says, okay, fine, we were wrong, who's really right? They go, that one? Him, the Jew, the weak, the downtrodden, the one that we've butchered and slaughtered and pushed down and pogromed and Holocaust and Inquisition, he's the one? That's going to be Akev. That's after. It's unexpected. It's a flipping of the whole system is going to be like, what? Can't be. He will unexpectedly finally be first, which is what Akev always means, unexpectedly to follow. And therefore, Akev is the unexpected result, the reward that one had not worked for, and therefore why Akev is also to do unexpected harm to someone to outwit him. All those terms of Akev are on the heel, after, unexpected, something that I wasn't planning. And Yitzchak sees his son holding on to the heel of his older brother, and sees in that a prophetic vision that this younger child is going to be weaker his whole life. He's not red and hairy and as robust and healthy as the older child. The older child, the first one out, is going to have this dominion over the world the whole time. And then at the very, very end, all of a sudden, the one that was weaker and downtrodden, but somehow always just stuck around. No matter how much he was pounded down, he never disappeared. He was just always there, always there, always there. And in the last second, holds on to the heel and will be the one that the world will look at. Totally unexpected, will be in control. And Yitzchak alone sees the significance of that. And therefore, Vayikra, he, singular, calls his name Yaakov, because only he sees in the significance of the Yaakov with a Yud in advance, which means he will. Akev is heel. Yaakov with the Yud is a futuristic tense. It will be that this child will be holding on to the heel. This child will come at the end and will take his position. I mentioned when I spoke, who names him that? Yitzchak. Tzachok means to laugh, also with the Yud, futuristic tense in front. He will laugh. Because while we're going through that long 2,000-year period, there's no laughter in the Jewish people. Just a lot of tears. But the name of he will laugh names his son, he will hold the heel. At the end, the laughter will come. Then there'll be a time when our mouths will be filled with laughter as the appropriate world power, the balance has shifted, the seesaw finally shifts back where the Jews in Yerushalayim are on top. The heel, the end of the day, the unexpected laughter will come, not just from us, but the whole world, when they'll say, we didn't know, we can't believe this, who would have thought? And the answer is, we did. We would have thought, and we were waiting, yearning for that time when the laughter will come and the final heel will be held by Yaakov. Okay.
Thank you for listening to Torah Media Atlanta. Won't you consider making a donation to help support this important work? Just go to TorahMediaAtlanta.com and click on the donate link. Thank you very much.